So where are we in this? Remember, that's the roadmap that we're following at the moment. On the left-hand side, the Hamiltonian formalism. On the right-hand side, the Lagrangian formalism. The Hamiltonian formalism being suitable for quantum theory because we know how that works with the Hilbert spaces and the operators and all that. And the right-hand side, the Lagrangian formalism being good for relativity because it allows us to write everything in a manifestly covariant way. So we started out with the Hamiltonian formalism and then moved to the Lagrangian formalism, all in special relativity. Then we introduced curvature. That's where we are now. And the next step is going to be to move over there today. So we will dwell a little bit on this. I will comment on that. And then we move this way. There we will be ready for quantization and then have quantum field theory in curved space. And that's just an alternative path entirely on the Lagrangian side that would get us to the path integral of quantum field theory. And the Hamiltonian formulation, also called the canonical formulation of quantum field theory, is equivalent to the Feynman formulation. And that can be shown by checking that the so-called Dyson-Schwinger equations, which are obeyed by the correlation functions, are the same. So we introduced curvature in the Lagrangian formalism. So what we are postulating is, in the case of the Klein-Gordon theory, that on curved space-time, the action for a Klein-Gordon field is given in this way. Here you recognize the kinetic term, and then the mass term, and in principle there could be some potential as well for the Klein-Gordon field. Here we have the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. We will here now allow almost arbitrary metric tensors g mu of x. In particular, we now allow tensors g mu of x, matrix valued functions of space and time, g mu of x, which cannot be brought into the form g mu is eta mu, no matter what coordinate system we choose. Remember, if we start with the theory in special relativity, then we can change coordinate system from Cartesian into other wild coordinates, and the metric tensor will then generally take the form of a space-time dependent matrix g mu of x. And then we can just perform a coordinate transformation backwards, and then we arrive again at a formulation where the metric simply takes the form eta mu nu. But there are also space-time dependent functions g mu of x, which under no coordinate transformations become simply eta mu nu. And these are the spacetimes which have curvature. However, we will not allow completely arbitrary g mu of x. I mean, for one thing, they have to be symmetric matrices, that's for sure, because of the interpretation of g mu as inducing infinitesimal distances. But more than that, we also want to enforce that at least locally, special relativity holds. That was one of the guiding principles for Einstein when he developed general relativity. The guiding principle was that for a freely falling observer in a small enough neighborhood, special relativity should hold to a good approximation. And what that means is, concretely, that while we do allow g mu of x, which cannot be transformed into eta mu nu globally, we only allowed functions g mu of x, which can be transformed by change of coordinates into the form eta mu nu at every point. So not simultaneously at all points, but for any point that we pick on the manifold, on the space-time, there ought to be a change of coordinates such that at that point, the metric tensor g mu of x takes the form eta mu nu. And therefore, also in the neighborhood of that point, the metric will not be very different from eta mu nu. And that means that in the neighborhood of every point, there is a coordinate system, which is effectively like a Cartesian coordinate system for a freely falling observer, in which effectively special relativity holds. And this is, of course, the famous equivalence principle. It amounts to postulating that gravity can always be locally eliminated. Locally, you can always go into a coordinate system that's freely falling and Cartesian, effectively Cartesian, for small enough distances from the point on the manifold that you're considering. And remember, when we speak of points of manifolds now, we mean events. It's not just a location. It's a location in space and in time. So we are assuming that if a freely falling observer in a small region sets up a rectangular coordinate system, then that observer will see only arbitrarily small gravity effects if the region is made arbitrarily small. So if you are in a freely falling rocket, a rocket whose engines are off, then you should not feel any impact of gravity. You should be, you know, floating. However, there are limitations to how big your spaceship can be. If your spaceship is huge, then you can notice, even if it's freely falling, you can notice that there's gravity around. And that's because there will be tidal forces. For example, if you are in such a spaceship and it is attracted to a planet, then if the spaceship is like 50 kilometers wide, then it cannot be freely falling with respect to both ends at the same time. Or let me put it this way, if you take a moon around a planet, such as our moon, around our sun, our Earth, it has an orbital period. It has a certain time that it takes to go once around the Earth, a month. But strictly speaking, the part of the moon that is closest to Earth would like to orbit the Earth faster. And the part of the moon that's furthest from the Earth would like to orbit the Earth at a slower frequency, because it's further out. And so there is actually, there are so-called tidal forces that rip on the moon. And if a moon actually gets too close to its planet, the moon does get ripped apart, literally because parts of it want to travel at different rotational frequencies. So even though the moon is freely falling, it's big enough, so the tidal forces are totally apparent. It's, by the way, the reason why the moon, the internal stresses of the moon lead to the phenomenon that if the moon was to rotate, then it would have to change shape. And that costs energy. And that's why the rotation of the moon has stopped. That's why the moon is always showing the same side to us, because of those tidal forces. Okay, so the equivalence principle talks about the local absence of curvature. Now, let us come back to a question that I raised last time. Imagine somebody gives you, God forbid, in an exam, two metric tensors, so g mu nu of x and g tilde mu nu of x. And then you're supposed to find out whether they describe the same space-time or not. In principle, all you have to do is simple. You have to check all possible coordinate transformations and see whether one metric can be obtained from the other metric by a coordinate transformation. It's just very difficult to try out all coordinate transformations because that includes all possible non-linear coordinate transformations, not just linear ones. And the special case of that question is the question, if I give you a metric, g mu nu of x, find out whether or not it describes Minkowski space, or whether it describes a space with space-time with curvature. This question can be addressed by introducing the so-called curvature tensor. So there is something we can calculate from the metric, which will tell us whether or not the space-time that's being described has curvature. So in this case, we don't have to try out all possible diffeomorphisms, all possible changes of coordinates. We can directly calculate a quantity from the metric that tells us whether or not there's curvature. And only if there's no curvature will the metric be equivalent to eta mu nu. Only then will there be a coordinate change such that it's obvious that the space-time is actually Minkowski space. So let's assume we are given a metric tensor g mu nu of x as an explicit matrix-valued function in some coordinates. Then we can ask, how can we find out whether or not this g mu nu of x is the metric tensor of a flat space-time? That is to say, whether there exists a coordinate system such that it just becomes eta mu nu everywhere at once or not. So that problem is solved in differential geometry. And the solution starts with defining the so-called Christoffel symbol functions. I'm assuming, of course, that you've all had a first course in general relativity, so I'm not trying to introduce everything from scratch, so most of what I'm saying here is meant to be a reminder. Remember, the overall goal is this. The input is just the function g mu nu of x, and the output, we want to be information about whether this space-time has curvature or not. And if it has curvature, how much and of what kind? So we take the g mu nu of x, and then we calculate from that g mu nu of x matrix-valued function this expression here, the gamma mu alpha beta of x. So the only information that's needed here is the g mu nu of x. And the commas, remember, the commas mean ordinary derivatives. So g alpha beta comma nu is the derivative of g alpha beta in the direction of x mu. So what do we have then? Then we have a function with three indices that depends on space and time. What can we do with that? Well, that's just an intermediate step. Once we have these functions, we use them to define the so-called Riemann curvature tensor. So we need to square those gammas, and we get two terms where they're products of gammas, and there are two terms where the gamma is linear, but it's differentiated. And overall, we end up with a matrix-valued function, a matrix-valued function of space and time that has four indices. Now, this is the quantity that we are really after. We say that a space-time has curvature at a point x if a vector that we parallel transport along an infinitesimal parallelogram returns in a rotated returns to the original point rotated relative to how it started. So let's say x is a point on the manifold, and here we choose a parallelogram, arbitrary infinitesimally small parallelogram defined by two vectors, the vector eta and the vector nu. So we use this parallelogram now in the following way. We take a vector at the point x, and then we parallel transport that vector in this direction, then that direction, and then back the other way along the parallelogram. And then we check whether the vector arrives back where it started, pointing in the same direction as when, whether its direction has changed during the trip, even though we parallel transported it. So we start with a vector v, and we parallel transport it, and when it comes back, it may point into a different direction. For example, if you start on the North Pole, and you stretch out your arm and you point towards the South Pole, then you can walk towards the equator, for example, and then once you arrive on the equator, always having parallel transported your arm, then, so now I'm standing at the equator. I've done this huge trip from the North Pole down, always pointing in some direction, for example, to the South Pole. And then I walk, let's say, leftwards on the equator, always parallel transporting my arm. I'm never on purpose turning around. So I walk along the equator for a while, and then I walk backwards up to the North Pole again. In this case, I didn't walk a parallelogram, I walk a triangle. But it's not important whether it's a parallelogram or triangle for that purpose. The point I want to make is that when I come back to the North Pole, obviously my arm is no longer pointing in the same direction, even though I parallel transported it all along that path. So a general method to detect curvature is to track how parallel transport is non-trivial. And it turns out that this is exactly what this matrix R is measuring. So the Riemann curvature tensor at the point X gives us the rotation matrix that this vector V undergoes. If this parallelogram is infinitesimal in size, then this rotation is also just an infinitesimal rotation, described by a matrix, a generator of rotations, a Hermitian matrix, like the symmetric matrix, so that when we exponentiate it to get a finite rotation, then we get a rotation matrix. Just like when you take a Hermitian matrix and you exponentiate it, you get a unitary, you take a symmetric, exponentiate it, get an orthogonal matrix. So at every point x on the manifold, the Riemann curvature tensor gives us a matrix, namely the matrix that describes the rotation that any vector will undergo as a result of such a trip. But the matrix has only two indices. This thing has four indices. What about the two extra indices here, the KNL index? It turns out that the KNL index are needed to describe, to specify which parallelogram we choose. You see, in four dimensions, there are many ways that you can choose parallelograms. So you pick a vector, a four vector, eta, and you pick a four vector, nu, and then you contract them, their coefficients, with the KL coefficients, and you've specified your parallelogram. Then you're left with a matrix R with indices I and J, and that's the matrix that rotates the vector. So you take the Riemann curvature tensor's matrix, contract it with the two vectors that describe the parallelogram. So eta with index b contracts here, and then the nu with index c contracts there, and then you're left with this matrix here, AD, which is a rotation matrix. So when you apply that rotation matrix on the vector v, you get its infinitesimal change. In principle, it is possible to design spacetimes such that the parallelogram does not even close. So that if you go in the direction of eta and then nu and then back eta and then back nu, you may not even arrive back at the same point. In this case, we say that the spacetime has torsion. Differential geometrically, this is a well-defined thing, but there is no evidence of torsion just yet in nature. If evidence for torsion were to be found, then the mathematics for it is ready. What I find interesting about this business with torsion is that setting torsion equal to zero is non-trivial when you look at the quantum theory. For example, for a harmonic oscillator in its ground state, the expectation value of the position is zero, but there are fluctuations around that. So similarly, one could imagine that in the classical theory, you have the distortion is zero, but that in the quantum theory, there are fluctuations around that. This is what I'm talking about is a special case of a much more general phenomenon, which is that when in a classical theory there is a constraint, such as no torsion, and you want to do the quantum theory of that, then it does make a difference whether you first implement the constraint and then do the quantum theory, or you first quantize and then implement the constraint. If you first implement a constraint, for example, by completely eliminating a variable, then the quantum theory can no longer quantum fluctuate around that constraint. But if you first quantize the theory without the constraint and then implement the constraint, then it could be that there will be fluctuations around that.
But this is only the case when you're trying to quantize the space-time, right? I mean, if you're creating the space-time as a background for quantizing the theory on it.
Well, that's right. This particular issue only comes up if you want to quantize the degrees of freedom of space-time themselves. But the point I made just after that, which is the point that in general, if you are implementing a constraint in a classical theory, and that could be a theory other than space-time's dynamics, any theory, if you want to implement a constraint there, then you have to make a decision at some point where in the procedure the constraint should be implemented, before or after quantization. Do you allow quantum fluctuations around the implementation of the constraint or not? Okay, so here's a proposition. Let's assume that in a region of space-time, all the components of the Riemann curvature tensor vanish for all locations in that region, then and only then there exist coordinates such that the metric tensor can be written as the metric tensor of Minkowski space. Only then it is Minkowski space, actually. So this saves us a lot of work in the sense that we don't have to check for the existence of changes of coordinates. If we find that there is curvature, then we know there cannot exist a coordinate system that would make g mu nu of x eta mu nu globally. By the way, we are, by implementing the equivalence principle, we are also implementing that we are not allowing metrics which, for example, would have a different signature. In principle, you could write down symmetric matrix-valued functions g mu nu of x, which, after a suitable coordinate transformation, locally take the form of a matrix which is plus 1, minus 1, minus 1. We don't want that either, because that would be a theory with two times. So by implementing the equivalence principle, by requiring that we can locally always transform g mu nu into the form of eta mu nu, we are ensuring that there's just one time variable. It is, by the way, still an unsolved problem whether, when we quantize gravity, we should allow the signature to fluctuate. Is that a constraint that should be implemented before we even quantize, that the metric has to have the signature that it has with just one time? Or should we allow quantum fluctuations around that? And it's part of the bigger question, how do we know how many dimensions space-time should have? Maybe there are more dimensions, and maybe it somehow arises dynamically that it has 3+1 dimensions. There are suggestions, for example, that when you probe space-time at very, very small distances, that its dimension effectively gets reduced, or even increased. Both have been suggested. So far, we've only described space-time. Now let us ask, what is the dynamics of space-time? It's all good and fine to recognize that space-time can have curvature. But in fact, it's more than just being able to have curvature. Space-time is a dynamical thing. It is something like a rigid piece of metal that, if struck, will start vibrating. In fact, it is super rigid. If you think of space-time as a dynamical object, you have to think of it as something that is elastic, but incredibly stiff. If it weren't, then you could just, you know, throw a ball and it would make tremendous gravitational waves. But as it is, you could throw the moon and it wouldn't make great gravitational waves. Gravity is rather weak. We say it's weak, but you can also view it as space-time being incredibly stiff. It takes enormously violent, enormously massive processes to create significantly strong gravitational waves. I mean, look how easily we are impacting electromagnetic waves. We all radiate heat radiation all the time. It's easily measurable. It's many orders of magnitude easier for us to make electromagnetic waves than it is to make gravitational waves. And you can view it as space-time being just incredibly stiff. So what is the dynamics of space-time? What are the equations of motion? And what are the degrees of freedom of space-time? What are the degrees of freedom of curvature? What is it that we have to find equations of motion for? So we saw that the curvature of space-time is encoded in the matrix-valued metric function. Right? Remember, once you have that, you have everything. Because from the G-mu of x, you can calculate the Christoffel symbols. And from them, you get the Riemann curvature tensor. So in principle, we can view the G-mu of x as the primary description of a space-time. But then remember that if we are given a G-mu of x that looks non-trivial, it is a 4x4 symmetric space-time dependent function that looks non-trivial, then it doesn't mean that the space-time is non-trivial. It could just mean that it's Minkowski space, but in funny coordinates. There are two different reasons for why G-mu could look non-trivial. It could be because space-time has no curvature or just very little curvature, but we've chosen a very complicated set of coordinates. Or it could be that we chose a very simple coordinate system, as simple as it got, but space-time really is curved. So we really cannot make the metric tensor look any simpler. And in particular, it cannot be it cannot be eta mu nu of Minkowski space for all x. So just by looking at the G-mu nu of x, there's no way of telling quickly whether it describes a complicated choice of coordinates for Minkowski space or the space-time really has some complicated curvature on it. And that means it's difficult to pinpoint in that matrix G-mu nu of x what the degrees of freedom are that we should quantize. We can't just put hats on the matrix elements of G-mu nu and then say, well, now let them fluctuate, let them be non-commutative. One reason being that much of the values of these matrix elements are our choice by choosing coordinates. And we definitely don't want to do a quantum theory of our choice. It's got to be a quantum theory of the curvature of space-time instead. So you might say then, okay, so maybe we shouldn't quantize the metric. Maybe we should just quantize the Riemann curvature tensor. But even the Riemann curvature tensor doesn't give us the pure, simple facts about the curvature of space-time. And that's because it too is not scalar, which means very much dependent on the choice of coordinates. If we change coordinates, then this matrix, this four-index matrix, gets multiplied with all those chain rule factors. So there too, we can't easily read off what the degrees of freedom are. It's a little bit more informative than the metric, because if this thing is zero in one coordinate system, then it's zero in all coordinate systems. So it tells us immediately if there are non-zero entries there, it tells us immediately there is some curvature, but it's not separated into purely the shape degrees of freedom of space-time and the coordinates. It's still a mix. So the idea then is that in order to describe the dynamics of space-time, we start with something that is not coordinate system dependent. And the obvious candidate for that is the action. The action is a scalar. It's always a scalar in any theory. And therefore, it is coordinate system dependent in particular. And therefore, whatever condition we put on the action, for example, stationarity, that the first functional derivative of the action is zero, that condition is then a coordinate system independent condition. If we spell it out and we obtain differential equations which take different coefficients and different coordinate systems, so be it. But we know at least that the condition that we put in to specify what the equations of motion are, that these conditions are coordinate system independent. So the idea is to define the action for gravity and then use that for an action principle in order to derive the equations of motion. So for that purpose, we need now a scalar. We need a scalar functional of the metric. Because after all, everything can be expressed in terms of the metric. So what we need is the action for gravity, and it's going to be something where you can plug in the metric and get out the scalar. What could that be? How can we calculate a scalar from the metric? Okay, so there is a very simple way to get a scalar from the metric. Just take the metric g mu nu with lower indices and the metric g mu nu with upper indices and contract them. That's going to give you a scalar. It's a boring scalar though, because it's just, what is it? It's 4, right? Because if you contract one of the pairs of indices, you get a delta mu mu, which you then contract, so you just get 4. So that's probably too poor to derive equations of motion. It just doesn't depend on the metric at all. So we need something more complicated to give us a non-trivial scalar from the metric. So let's see what simple thing we can build. Now, we already built the Riemann curvature tensor from the metric. Let us contract two of its indices, this one, middle one down there. And we obtain the so-called Ricci tensor. Now the first question should be, why the middle one? What happens if I use other ones? Well, it turns out that the Riemann curvature tensor has a lot of symmetries and anti-symmetries in it. And this is effectively the only choice you can do. All other choices are obtained by rotating indices. So we simplify the Riemann curvature tensor to obtain the Ricci tensor, which has only two indices. Let me make a comment about the Ricci tensor. You may wonder, if we contract these things, then this tensor probably has less information about the shape of the space-time in it than that one. The idea is that this is a sum of terms in here. If, for example, I give you the sum of two numbers, I tell you the sum of two numbers is 7, you don't know whether I obtained that from adding 1 plus 6 or 5 plus 2, right? And so similarly, we would expect that this contains less information than that, and that's strictly true. This tensor knows more information than that one. Or you can also put it this way. If the Ricci tensor vanishes, that doesn't imply that the Riemann curvature tensor vanishes. This can be 0, and that is still non-zero. That actually occurs. That situation occurs. For example, out in space between the sun and the earth, just where there's empty space, the Ricci tensor vanishes, but the Riemann curvature tensor doesn't. The Riemann curvature, the Ricci tensor, it turns out, is only non-zero where there is matter. Only where there is matter in the form of energy or momentum. In other words, wherever there is a non-zero energy momentum tensor, that's, it turns out later, that's where the Riemann curvature tensor is non-zero. But between matter distributions, between the sun and the earth, it's still curvature. If there weren't, how would the earth know that it has to orbit the sun? Right? So there is curvature, but it's a different kind of curvature. The curvature that's described by the Ricci tensor is called the Ricci curvature, and the curvature that's described by the remaining degrees of freedom is called the Weil curvature. So I just want to highlight at this point that we are reducing the amount of information available by making that contraction and working now with the Ricci tensor. So Arminu has less information than that. By the way, you are familiar with a similar decomposition. In electromagnetism, for example, consider the electric field. It's a three-component vector field. And I hope you remember that that a three-dimensional vector field can be decomposed into a gradient and into a curl. And the curl part has a different Maxwell equation than the gradient part has. And so, similarly, the curl of an electric field is produced differently than the gradient of an electric field is produced. And so similarly, the Weil curvature and the Ricci curvature have different origin. So now we do a further restriction of the degrees of freedom. We take the Ricci tensor and contract it with G mu nu in order to get the scalar. So remember, the overall aim was to get the simplest possible scalar that we can think of. To be used as the action for gravity. We already had the scalar. It was just a contraction of G mu nu with itself. It was just 4. And we decided that's not informative enough. But actually, it will turn out to be super important. It's just not enough. So the next simplest thing is this scalar. Now let's see what other scalars could be formed. As I said, G mu nu is a scalar, but it's just 4. Then we found the Ricci scalar, R of x. And a detailed study shows that all other scalars that you can create, starting from the metric, because that's the only, the metric knows everything. So you can ask, what other scalars can I build from the metric? Well, all the other scalars are obtained by contracting Ricci scalars and Riemann curvature tensors and their derivatives. But it doesn't get any simpler than that. There are many other ways to form scalars. And in 3+1 dimensions, how many is it? I think it's 10 of those expressions that are functionally independent of each other at each point. So there are many terms you could write down, but these are the simplest. And so now we are ready to construct an action that includes gravity. So S subscript total is now an ansatz for an action that describes the matter fields, radiation fields. Remember that for cosmologists, radiation counts as matter. There's no distinction made in the terminology. So now we want to describe the action for a theory that contains matter and radiation and curvature. Let us write it in this way. The action depends on the metric, therefore on the shape of the spacetime, on phi, the Klein-Gordon field that we are interested in for the purpose of cosmology, and little phi, which has an index I, and it in principle stands for all other fields that there exist in nature. For example, the field for gluons, the field for electrons, the field for the up quark, and the field for the tau neutrino. All of these things would be described by labeling these phi I. So the total action of our theory is given by the Klein-Gordon action for the field phi, the action for all the other fields, and the action for gravity. And of course, these terms contain interaction terms between them as well, if there are interactions. And now we have an idea for how the gravity action should look like. The gravity action should be composed of all the scalars that can be built out of the metric. And that starts with a constant, well, a multiple of 4, right? This is a multiple of g mu. And then some constant, some prefactor in front of the Ricci scalar, then some prefactor constant, which is r mu. That's the next simplest term you can build. And then higher powers of the Riemann curvature tensor and its covariant derivatives contracted so that you get at the end a scalar. In principle, the curvature action, the action for gravity should contain any number of these terms. Experimentally, there is evidence for the presence of the first two terms. We believe that because of higher order effects in gravity, in the interaction of matter with gravity, there should be, in principle, a whole series of terms, probably all possible scalars. You see, matter interacts with space-time, and then the curvature of space-time back reacts on matter, and then that back reacts on the space-time. And this ping-ponging of mutual impact, as far as we know, should produce all possible terms that you could write down, all possible scalars there. In fact, that is ultimately the statement of non-renormalizability of gravity. If gravity was a simpler theory, then that wouldn't happen. This series would truncate somewhere. But as far as we know, it doesn't truncate. And that is a problem for the predictive power of gravity. It has lots of problems. Lots of problems come with that. Certain infinities don't go away in quantum field theory and so on. Cauchy problems are hard or impossible to define in space-times with this kind of action. But also, simply the predictive power of such a theory is quite limited, because in principle, you would have to perform an infinite number of experiments to determine those infinitely many coefficients in that series. And that's not nice. It's much nicer. It would be much more powerful if your theory was determined by just two coefficients. You measure two things, and then you can make an infinite number of predictions. However, space-time is incredibly stiff. And that, it turns out, means that these coefficients, the higher order coefficients here, if they exist, are tremendously small. So that in normal circumstances, where space-time is not sufficient, is not significantly curving, or where gravitational waves are not dominant over what the matter does, these terms can seemingly be neglected if they exist, if they even exist. So far, experimental evidence only exists for the first two terms. The first term is the term which is really a multiple of 4, a multiple of g mu, is called the cosmological constant. And the second term, which is just the Ricci scalar, is the Einstein-Hilbert action. Also, these constants have to be such that experiments are matched, and these are the values you have to choose in order to match experiments, where capital G is Newton's constant. So this much of that entire series, just those first two terms, is called the Einstein action, where Einstein was himself not so sure whether that should be part of it or not. At different points in his career, he thought that that term should be there or should not be there. Now, of course, we know that the cosmological constant is super important because it contributes about 70% of all of the energy density in the universe. By the way, as I mentioned previously, if you put higher order terms here, then you should expect that the equations of motion become quickly unmanageable. And the reason is that the Ricci and the Riemann curvature tensors are expressed in terms of the metric and its derivatives. So if you have higher powers of the Riemann curvature tensor here, then you end up having higher powers of derivatives of the metric. And then if you want to calculate the equations of motion, you can easily have equations of motion that have higher than second derivatives in them. And now, just intuitively, you might think, okay, higher than second derivatives means I just need to put more initial conditions, and then that will still fix the evolution. But it's not so easy in this case. And in general, it's highly non-trivial to even have a well-defined initial value problem. So there was a fellow by the name of Lovelock, I think he's still alive, who worked this out. And he checked, what can we add there? What kind of terms can we add without screwing up the predictability, the predictive power of our theory? What terms can we add there so that we still have well-defined Cauchy problems? And he found that this is basically all you can do in 3 plus 1 dimensions. But he also found that in more than 3 plus 1 dimensions, you can have more terms. In more than 3 plus 1 dimensions, there is more. There are more possibilities there. And that's known under the name of Lovelock gravity. Lovelock, by the way, was here at Waterloo in the Applied Math Department when he did that work. So what then are the equations of motion? The action principle, as usual, is to require that the action is extremal with respect to all degrees of freedom. Remember, we have 3 kinds of degrees of freedom. We have the degrees of freedom of all the standard model fields, such as the electrons fields, the gluons, W and Z bosons, the Higgs particle, and so on. And then there are the degrees of freedom of matter represented by the metric. And then there are the degrees of freedom of the Klein-Gordon field. And we want the total action to be extremal with respect to variations of any one of those fields, all of them. So in particular, we want that the usual equations of motion for the standard model particles arise by functionally differentiating the total action with respect to phi and setting that equal to zero. Where these equations of motion, such as the Dirac equation for electrons, will be affected. They are not the usual ones that you will find in textbooks. And the reason is that even the part of the total action that contains only, let's say, the electron field, it, strictly speaking, doesn't contain just the electron field. It also always contains the metric, because the metric is needed to create the scalars. For one thing, everything in the action is multiplied with the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. So everything, all terms, are in some way more or less dependent on the metric. So all of the equations of motion are impacted by the presence of curvature. So what we obtain here is that the standard model equations of motion are covariantized for general relativity when we perform this procedure. And by the way, what this also means is that now every kind of field, at least indirectly, interacts with every other kind of field. So for example, neutrinos would normally not interact with photons, right? Because they are neutral. However, neutrinos impact gravity. The neutrino action has the metric in it, and so does the photon action. So through gravity, in principle, they interact. So if there's a neutrino and a photon, normally they would, according to the standard model on Minkowski space, you know, they could just pass through each other. But in principle, the neutrino will curve space, and the photon will see that, and vice versa. It's just that space-time is so incredibly stiff. That little bit of energy from the neutrino or the photon is not going to measurably affect the motion of the other. But in principle, everything is connected to everything because the metric meddles with every action. It's contained in every action. Okay, so how would we proceed then? Well, we have an action principle for all the matter fields of the standard model. Then we can read off from the action what the Lagrangian is. Remember, that's just if we remove the time integral, then we get the Lagrangian. Then we can do the Legendre transform, we get the Hamiltonian, and then we impose the canonical commutation relations, etc. And then we get the covariant version of the Dirac equation for the electron, for example. Now, from now onwards, we will neglect the standard model fields. We will only be caring about the dynamics of the metric and the dynamics of the Klein-Gordon field. So now, the second action principle is this. The functional derivative of the total action with respect to the metric should also be zero. So this gives us the equation of motion for the dynamics of curvature. This gives us the Einstein equation. And if you, I'm assuming that you've done some GR before. If you want to see more detailed derivation of this action principle, then I can refer you to my lecture notes from the course that I taught last term. Regarding the structure of the Einstein equation, when we calculate this functional derivative, it consists of the functional derivative with respect to the metric of two kinds of terms. On one hand, there's the functional derivative of the gravity action. But as we just discussed, the metric is contained everywhere in every one of the terms of the action. Even the neutrino action has the metric in it. Even if only just because of the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of G, measure factor. So the metric occurs in the total action everywhere. There is a term dedicated to just the metric, that's the cosmological constant, and the Ricci scalar term. But then all the other terms for the Klein-Gordon field and for the other fields of the standard model, they will also all have the metric in them. And so let's look at what we obtain when we differentiate the total action with respect to the metric, and we focus on the term that's dedicated to the metric. So the cosmological constant term and the Ricci scalar. The functional derivative of this part of the action with respect to the metric is this. That is traditionally written as the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. And then we also have that the functional derivative of the remainder has to be evaluated. That part is traditionally not added to the left-hand side, and then we say equal to zero, but instead we put a minus sign on it and put it on the right-hand side. So that is the functional derivative of the total action for all the matter fields, Klein-Gordon and all the other standard model fields. The functional derivative with respect to the metric of those guys goes to the right-hand side, and what you then get is the energy momentum tensor. By definition, that is what is called the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so the left-hand side of the Einstein equation is ds gravity, just the gravity part, differentiated with respect to the metric. And the right-hand side is d of the other action, other fields actions, standard model fields actions, and the Klein-Gordon action, functionally differentiated with respect to the metric, with a minus sign. Because in principle, the equation of motion is that this plus that is equal to zero. So what we see here is that the energy momentum tensor is a hodgepodge of stuff. This thing is really the sum of a lot of terms. That's because the standard model of particle physics has a lot of different species of particles in there. And each of those species of particles has an action which has the metric in it. Whenever indices need to be contracted, the metric is involved. And also the square root of g in the metric and the measure factor is there. So all the various species of particles are going to contribute to the energy momentum tensor. It turns out that in the very early universe cosmology, one of those terms is dominant. And that's the term that comes from the Klein-Gordon field of the inflaton field. And so I wrote up for you, because you will need it quite a bit in this course, what the contribution is from the Klein-Gordon field. So the Klein-Gordon field is one of those matter fields that in its action has the metric tensor. And if we functionally differentiate the Klein-Gordon action with respect to the metric, this is what we get. So the contribution to the energy momentum tensor from the Klein-Gordon field is given by this kinetic term here, which contains the derivatives of the field. But notice that even though it is generally called the kinetic term, it contains not just time derivatives, which is where the mu and the nu are zero, it also contains space derivatives. And similarly here, we again have kinetic contributions. And then here we have a potential term. If the Klein-Gordon field in question has a mass term, something like m squared phi squared, it would, in this notation, show up among the potential terms. So for example, let's look at what T naught naught is. If you remember, T naught naught is the energy density. Whereas you would get the pressure for the TII components. If you calculated the T mu nu, for example, for some sort of gas, then a gas has energy density, but it also has pressure. And I'm just mentioning that because the energy momentum tensor for a gas is intuitive. we can tell what the TII components mean. For a gas, the TII components mean the pressure. And so that terminology is often also imported into cosmology, where we are not talking about a gas, but instead we are talking about a Klein-Gordon field and its energy moment tensor. And when then people speak of the pressure in the vacuum, what they mean is really just the TII components of the energy momentum tensor. Now let us look at how that looks like in Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates, just to see whether it makes sense. So in Minkowski space, the G mu nu of x is just eta mu nu in Cartesian coordinates. And when we are looking at T naught naught, what do we have? Well, T naught naught of x is then, well, you see, it's the time derivative, d by dt, so it's phi dot squared, minus, and then the 0, 0 component is a plus 1 in this notation. And then here we have a 1/2, and then here again we have g naught naught is 1, and here we have the time derivative, so we have phi dot squared again. So we have phi dot...
Why are alpha and beta 0?
The sum.
Oh, no, that's right. No, in this case, we have to sum of all of them. This is just one of the terms. Correct. It's just one of the terms, which is the phi dot squared. But it's 1/2 with a minus. So overall, it's a plus 1/2 phi dot squared. This term plus that term plus the spatial one. So plus the spatial derivatives. And they're plus 1/2 because there's a minus from here, but also a minus from the G mu nu with a negative values there. And then here is the potential. Okay. So later we will study exactly why this term is dominant and how it plays a role in cosmology. Okay, so now that we have the Einstein action and the equations of motion, it would seem that we are ready to quantize gravity. Now, it's difficult though. For example, it's difficult to separate the curvature degrees of freedom from what are merely artifacts of the choice of coordinate system, as we discussed many times. Also, the Einstein equation is actually highly nonlinear. And so far, all attempts have run into severe difficulties. Even the perturbation theory of gravity is difficult because, just intuitively, imagine you consider a metric, you write it down as g mu nu of x, and then you want to change it just a little bit. Well, imagine you do a change of coordinates. By a change of coordinates, you can change what the value of a particular matrix element of your metric tensor is. You can make it go from 5 to 5 million just by changing coordinates. So it's difficult to keep track of what are small numbers when everything is modulo coordinate transformation. It's a very difficult business, and in particular in the context of cosmology, as we will discuss later on, it took almost 20 years of totally and sometimes partially wrong papers until it was figured out how to do the perturbation theory then. So in this course, we will initially play it completely safe, and we will not quantize gravity to start with. Instead, we will assume that a background spacetime is given. We will assume that we know the time evolution of spacetime. It's a classical time evolution. There's the g mu nu of x, which describes the evolution of spacetime from the earliest times until today, or something like that. And it's just a classical thing. Just g mu nu of x. There's no hat over anything to do with the metric. The metric is just a classical background spacetime. And then we consider a a scalar field, the Klein-Gordon field, that lives on that background classical given space-time. And we ask, how is our scalar field impacted by the fact that we are not having it live on Minkowski space, but on an expanding space-time? That alone is already highly non-trivial, because the expansion of space-time can act in the Klein-Gordon equation like a change of parameters. See, the Klein-Gordon equation has the D'Alembertian in it, and its parameters will be space and time dependent if the metric is space and time dependent, because the metric enters into the D'Alembert operator. So therefore, the dynamics of the Klein-Gordon field will be impacted. It is as if we had parametrically driven harmonic oscillators. And all sorts of effects can occur because of that. And then once we are familiar with this, we will go one step further. And we will take into account that the metric degrees of freedom, that a certain part of the metric degrees of freedom, cannot be strictly distinguished from the degrees of freedom of the Klein-Gordon field. You see, the Einstein equation links the two. The Klein-Gordon field produces an energy momentum tensor, and that energy momentum tensor has an impact on the metric, has an impact on the curvature. So the two things are linked to each other. And if the Klein-Gordon field is fluctuating, the energy momentum tensor is fluctuating, which means the curvature has to fluctuate, means the metric has to fluctuate, and vice versa. It turns out that there is a fusion happening between the degrees of freedom of the Klein-Gordon field and one part of the metric, a scalar part of the metric, which is of the same nature as the Klein-Gordon field. Those two degrees of freedom merge. They cannot be strictly distinguished, because you can always choose a coordinate system in which it looks as if one of the two degrees of freedom was zero and only the other one exists. But you can choose a coordinate system where it looks like the Klein-Gordon field is non-zero and fluctuating and all of that, but the scalar part of the curvature is not fluctuating. But there are also coordinate systems in which it looks as if the Klein-Gordon field has everywhere the same value, but the metric is fluctuating. And that's the part that took so many years to figure out. But in any case, we will do this, and then we will quantize that merged degrees of freedom, which is called the Mukhanov variable. And that is the degree of freedom whose quantum theory then describes the origin of the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. And in this way, we are, in a sense, truly quantizing gravity, because we are quantizing a part of the metric equations. And similarly, we will look at the polarization of gravitational waves. We will find that gravitational waves too obey equations of motion that are similar to those of the Klein-Gordon field. And therefore, also the gravitational waves will be, to some extent, excited parametrically because of the enormous expansion of the universe very early on. Now, the impact of that is on the verge of being observed. There has been already a lot of excitement about experimental statements that these gravitational waves, the impact of these primordial gravitational waves, has been measured. But it turns out that it was probably just noise that they saw. In any case, so what I wanted to say is that we will start out with quantizing the Klein-Gordon field on a given fixed space-time metric. And by fixed, I don't mean constant in time. No, it's varying. The universe is expanding. By fixed, I mean we are not considering the action of the fluctuations of the phi field on the metric just yet. But then later, we will take that into account. And in this way, in a sense, we will quantize, at least perturbatively, some part of the metric, some part of the curvature. Okay, so we have looked at the action principle for the standard model fields. We looked at this action principle for the metric. And now we're looking at the action principle for the Klein-Gordon field. Now, the phi field occurs only in the Klein-Gordon action. So therefore, the functional derivative of the total action with respect to phi is the functional derivative of the Klein-Gordon action with respect to phi. Now let's remember what the action is of the Klein-Gordon field. Here it is. We started out the lecture today with it. I've included now, in addition to the kinetic term or generalized kinetic term, because it has spatial derivatives too, I've also included a mass term and a lambda phi to the 4 term, just to give you an example of how the potential terms could look like. Then let's apply the Euler-Lagrange equations. We saw how we can calculate the functional derivative of the Klein-Gordon action with respect to phi. And remember, if we write it like this, what we mean is we functional differentiate the action with respect to all occurrences of phi, whether it be naked or differentiated, all of them. But then we can also use the lemma that we introduced last time to calculate this derivative more directly. And for that purpose, we then view the action as being a functional of the field and all of its derivatives separately. Then this equation becomes that equation using the lemma. The lemma which said, if you want to functionally differentiate a functional with respect to the derivative of a function, then you can do that by differentiating as if it was an independent variable, as long as you keep track of also differentiating afterwards with respect to that coordinate. So the Euler-Lagrange equations that came from that were that the action differentiated with respect to phi, undifferentiated, is equal to the derivative of the action differentiated with respect to all of its differentiated occurrences. If we do this, then we obtain the Klein-Gordon equation in general relativity. Actually, we can just do this. So here's the action. If we differentiate with respect to all occurrences of phi that are undifferentiated, well, where are they? Well, here and there. Right? So these are the occurrences of phi undifferentiated. And if we differentiate with respect to phi, we get these terms. We get 1/2 m squared and 2 phi of x. 2 because, you know, that's the phi squared. We get a 2 down. We get that term. And then when we differentiate this term with respect to phi, we get the 4 times phi to the third. And of course, we get rid of the integral by doing the functional differentiation. And then that square root of g is still carried forward. And that is equal to the derivative, yes, the derivative of the functional derivative of s with respect to its differentiated occurrences. And the differentiated occurrences are here. So what we get is the g mu and then the derivative. And that square root of g is just carried forward. This, however, is not the way that the Klein-Gordon equation is usually presented. Instead, things are a little bit reordered. And we divide the equation by square root of g. And then that's the presentable form of the Klein-Gordon equation. These are the usual terms, just m squared phi plus 2 lambda phi to the third. And this is what happens to the D'Alembert operator in curved space-time. Let's see what it is if the metric is just eta. If we go back to Minkowski space and Cartesian coordinates, if the metric is just eta, this is 1, and that is 1. And this is eta mu nu. In this case, we have eta mu nu here, and here we have the derivatives. So this is just d by dx nu, or d by dx mu, actually, once we've contracted with the eta. And here we have that. It's just the sum of the second derivatives, just like the Laplacian, but with the minus sign for the time. No, minus sign for the space variables in this case. So this is reduces to the usual D'Alembertian in Minkowski space. But it is the covariant generalization of it. So it's a generalized second derivative operator. It contains first and second derivatives of the field. So the D'Alembert operator is all of this on the left, by definition, all of that stuff. So the Klein-Gordon equation with this definition in general relativity takes this form. If for the potential we choose lambda phi to the 4 and the mass term. All right, so we are here now. We arrived here. We introduced curvature. And we are basically ready for this step here with the Legendre transform to the Hamiltonian formalism. But there is also a way, using not perimeter institute, but the path integral, to go here to the path integral formulation. And just very briefly, we will have an entire lecture on this, but at the very end. But just very briefly, let's assume that a fixed space-time is chosen and we are given the metric of it, g mu of x, in some arbitrary coordinate system. Then for every field phi, because remember, this is just a fixed background, right? So now for every field phi, we can calculate its action. We can actually calculate that number because the metric is assumed given and we've chosen the field phi. So we can calculate the action and that's just a number. And remember, nothing is operator valued here. This is a number valued field. The metric is, as usual, matrix valued. So we can calculate that number for every field phi. And then following Feynman, who followed an idea of Dirac, we can define a formal probability amplitude for a particular field evolution phi as being given by e to the power of I over h bar, and then the Klein-Gordon action of the field phi. So this is as if we had, sorry. This is as if we had a probability distribution, except that these are probability amplitudes. It's a non-normalized probability amplitude. We still need to normalize these things. So then, for example, let's say we wanted to calculate what the correlation function is in the vacuum for the Klein-Gordon field. So this is literally the correlator for what the field does at one location x and what the field does at another location x prime. Let's say at equal time. See, if the field phi at x fluctuates completely independently of how the field fluctuates at the position x prime, if these fluctuations have nothing to do with another, then the expectation value of their product is zero. Because, I mean, these values fluctuate, those values fluctuate, but you get positive values in the product as much as you get negative ones. It's completely, completely uncorrelated. If this value is 3, you're...
Sorry. Is there some reason why t has to be the same in both of those?
No, but I'm keeping it simple here.
Okay.
For example, if this value was to fluctuate to be 3, if they were completely independent, this would have an equal chance of being plus 5 as being minus 5. So the plus 5 occurs as often as the minus 5, which means that the overall contribution is 0. So when two things are uncorrelated, in the sense of statistically independent, then the expectation value of their product is 0. If the expectation value of the product is positive, it means that they are correlated, which means that if this is a positive value, that is more likely to be positive than negative. If this is negative, then that is more likely to be negative than positive. That's what it means, that the correlator is positive. And that means that they are correlated. If the expectation value was negative, it would mean that if that's positive, that has a larger than chance probability of being negative. But the signs are opposite, right? Okay, later we will calculate these things using the Hamiltonian formalism, commutators, and Hilbert spaces and all of that. But Feynman found out that you can shortcut this and you can get these super important correlations. And I'm saying they're super important because ultimately everything about the quantum theory is encoded in those, in this case, two-point functions or endpoint functions. All the scattering probabilities of particles and all of that are encoded in these correlators. Feynman found out that there's a shortcut to calculating these. Namely, if you know the probability amplitudes for a particular field evolution, right? So for every field evolution phi of x and t, you can calculate its probability amplitude for occurring as this complex number. If you know those, you should be able to work out, should be able to work out what the overall probability is. So this two-point correlator can then be written in this way, two-point correlator. Instead of calculating it like this in the Hamiltonian formalism with Hilbert spaces and operators, you can also instead do a functional integral, a so-called path integral over all fields phi, and they are classical fields at this point. And then each of those field values gets plugged into the Klein-Gordon action. You calculate the probability amplitude, and then you multiply that probability amplitude with the product of the two field values at x and x prime. So you're literally calculating what the correlator is. So you take the product of the two values, multiply with the probability that they occur, and sum over all possibilities. That still needs to be normalized, but in principle, in statistical mechanics, this is how you would calculate the correlator, or in statistics generally, except that this would have to be a probability, not a probability amplitude. But then we are doing quantum theory here, not classical probability theory. So Feynman found that that's a shortcut way to do it, except there are some problems, like this functional integral is not well defined, actually. It's a hell of an integral, and analytically nobody has been able to make full sense of this. But you can do formal manipulations with this and eventually arrive at results that may be a little harder to justify because it's a little hairy how to derive these things, but you arrive at ultimately the same final answer as if you calculate it this way. Okay, so I just gave you a bit of an indication of how this is going to go at the end, but our aim is to now do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formalism, where we then can quantize the theory and obtain Hilbert space representations, and Fock spaces, and operators, and unitary time evolutions, and things like that. Okay, so let me quickly indicate how that Legendre transform backwards goes. In particular, we will find now the answer to the question, what is pi? The canonically conjugate momentum field. And so we started with phi, and then we said in Minkowski space, the canonically conjugate field to that is just phi dot. But then we said, in general relativity, this got to be more complicated. And I gave you this example that if you just rescale the time variable, if you go from a one time variable t to a new time variable tau, which is a nonlinear function of t, you pick up a chain rule factor, right? And that would mess up the definition. You can't have in a general relativistic theory that pi is simply phi dot. So what is it then? What is the canonically conjugate field to phi? Now we can do it because we have the action. Therefore, by dropping the time integral, we get the Lagrangian, which we can then Legendre transform. And in this way, we get, we Legendre transform the variable phi dot to obtain then what the pi is over there.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
How do you decide which time integral to drop? Because
it's okay. The thing is that it doesn't matter. You can choose any which time variable you want. Remember that the formalism here is completely invariant under your choice of coordinate system. And it is true that what you end up getting depends on your choice, but the physics doesn't depend on it. You see, that's the miracle thing here, that once we have everything covariantly, then whatever we do next, as long as we don't change the theory, will still be a covariant theory. So when we go from here to there with a Legendre transform, all we really have to worry about is, are we doing the Legendre transform properly in the sense that it is still invertible, right? And are we taking everything into account? Are we really transforming the equations of motion from here to the equations of motion there in an invertible way? Well, then we know that we haven't changed the theory. On this side, it doesn't look covariant at all, but it is covariant because we've made sure that the equations of motion here exactly imply the equations of motion there and vice versa. So we're doing a transformation that is not in itself covariant, but we're not changing the theory. We're just changing the way we represent it. Okay, so the Klein-Gordon action looks like this. I'm dropping the phi to the fourth term now, but we're keeping the mass term. But the phi to, I mean, it wouldn't make a difference. If we had the phi to the fourth term, everything would go down the same way. So the equation of motion that we obtained from this Klein-Gordon action, so ds Klein-Gordon by d phi equals 0, was this one. Remember, on the left-hand side, we had this complicated-looking Klein-Gordon D'Alembertian. Now, from the action, we can read off what the Lagrangian is. So here's the action. And remember, here we integrate d4x. If we want the Lagrangian, we just don't integrate over time. And as you said, right away, that's something that is making it no longer covariant. I mean, theory remains covariant. It's just the way we write things is not covariant. It's not obviously covariant. So now we can perform that third step. We do the Legendre transform in which we reformulate our equations of motion. We reformulate what we consider to be our variables. But ultimately, as we did in the previous lecture, we keep track of what happens to the equations of motion so that they are completely equivalent. So now we do the Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formalism. Remember, we are on the right-hand side, the Lagrangian column. We have the Lagrangian, over here it is. And now we do the Legendre transform backwards. So we do the Legendre transform with respect to the variable d by d phi dot. This is phi comma 0. Right? We want to know what is the canonically conjugate variable to that. That's going to be pi. So that's, we can work that out. So the canonically conjugate field pi to phi is obtained by taking the Lagrangian and functionally differentiating it with respect to phi dot. So we do dl by d phi comma 0. So if we differentiate that with respect to phi comma 0, then we get two terms, which is why this 1/2 goes away. We get the square root of g that's carried forward here. And we get the term g 0 nu from the term where we hit the 0. And we get the other term. So what we get is the square root of g, and then g naught mu times phi comma mu. It's just simply the functional derivative with respect to phi comma 0 of this first term. And looking at that, we notice that this is four terms, because there's the sum over mu. Well, let's see what happens if we restrict to the case of Minkowski space and Cartesian coordinate. In this case, g mu nu is just eta mu nu. And then if this is eta mu nu, there's just one term contributing, which is the eta 0, 0. And eta 0, 0 occurs when mu is equal to 0, so that's the time derivative here. And the g, the determinant of g is 1 if g is eta. So what we find is that in Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates, pi is just phi dot. But even in Minkowski space, if you chose coordinates that are somehow funny, then you can have a metric which doesn't vanish for g naught mu. And then you get that the pi is not just proportional to phi dot in general in a space-time dependent way, but it will also have space derivatives in it. The canonically conjugate field will depend, will be a linear combination of both the time derivatives and the space derivatives. You have a question?
I was just going to say that since you're already picking up a notion of time, can we not just go to Riemann normal coordinates and just take g0i all of the others to 0?
We can go to Riemann normal coordinates, but then that gives us a simpler way of writing things just around one point. So, I mean, Riemann normal coordinates is just a particular kind of coordinate system, which is very convenient around one point, around the point around which we develop Riemann normal coordinates, but not in general. So explicitly, it's this. If we add up these four terms, so these are four terms. If we write out what the sum is, we find that the canonically conjugate momentum field is square root of g times g naught naught times the time derivative plus those terms square root of g times the space derivatives. But either way, even if there are these terms, the space derivatives, we are either way in luck. Because if you remember for the Legendre transform, we have to invert the new definition of the variable, the definition of the new variable, right? So we defined the new variable pi in terms of the old variable phi dot. But ultimately, in order to perform the Legendre transform, we must be able to express phi dot also in terms of pi so that we can replace all occurrences of phi dot through occurrences of pi, because the Hamiltonian at the end is no longer allowed to have any phi dots in it. That's the variable that we wanted to get rid of. It was a variable of the Lagrangian. It's not a variable of the Hamiltonian. And because this is how the canonically conjugate momentum field looks like, we can always do that inversion. We simply have to solve that equation for phi dot, for phi comma zero. And if we do that, if we just solve that equation for phi comma zero, we obtain that phi comma zero, or phi dot, is equal to pi divided by g naught naught minus this. So that means we can actually carry out the Legendre transform explicitly. And here's what we obtain. We obtain that the Hamiltonian is, as usual for a Legendre transform, the product of the new variable times the old variable, phi dot, but the old variable has to be expressed in terms of the new variables only, but we know how to do this, right? It's going to be these terms. So the Hamiltonian is new variable times old variable summed over all possible ones, so over all x, minus the old functional. This was the Lagrangian. And again, in the Lagrangian, we have to replace all occurrences of phi dot using this by occurrences of pi. So that at the end of the day, we just get a Hamiltonian which depends on only h and pi. And you can imagine that this is initially a little tedious, but once we have that, we can then calculate the equations of motion. I didn't spell out what the Hamiltonian is. We will get to that next time. Just saying that once we have the Hamiltonian and simplify the way it looks like, then we get, as usual, the equations of motion that phi dot is equal to dh by d pi, and pi dot is equal to minus dh by d phi. And we are now here. So now we have a Hamiltonian formulation of a covariant theory, of a general relativistically covariant theory, and we can then quantize that. Okay? That's as far as we got today. Yes?
Yeah,
When you selected the time direction for the Hamiltonian formalism, it was just arbitrary, so it could have been a Legendre transform with respect to z direction. Am I right?
No, we chose the time direction so that we get the Hamiltonian, so that it gives us the time evolution, not the space evolution. But you're right in the sense that we could have chosen different time variables. We could have chosen a new coordinate system with a different time variable that depends non-linearly on the old time and space variables, and then we could have done a Legendre transform with respect to those. And an important thing that will come up there, and we'll later analyze that in detail, is this. We get two notions of energy. Remember, we defined the energy momentum tensor just now. It's the functional derivative of the total action. Now, actually, just the matter part of the action, just the standard model fields and so on. Functional derivative with respect to the metric, right? That was T mu nu. And T0,0 is the energy density. If I integrate that over all of space, I get the total energy, like the Hamiltonian. But remember, the Hamiltonian, we just calculated very differently. We calculated the Hamiltonian by doing a Legendre transform with respect to phi dot. So then the question is, how does this Hamiltonian that we calculated through the Legendre transform relate to the space integral over T naught naught? And it turns out they are not the same. They're not the same. And then you have to ask, so which one of them is generating our time evolution? And the one that is generating our time evolution is the one that we just calculated. Because, you know, when we do the Legendre transform, we keep track of what happens to our equations of motion. We make sure that this Hamiltonian is generating our time evolution. In fact, with respect to the time variable that we chose, we get a different Hamiltonian for different choices of time coordinates. We should, because different choices of time coordinates require different generators of time evolution. So we get one Hamiltonian to generate the time evolution of our degrees of freedom. We get another Hamiltonian, the integral over the T naught naught, which generates curvature. You see, the T naught naught is the energy density. That's the thing that's in the Einstein equation. That's the one that generates curvature in space and time. That generates the Ricci curvature through the Einstein equation. And we will, as we will later see, sometimes they coincide. We will get to that in detail.
I'm just curious, like, is this second Hamiltonian the one which generates Komar mass?
And does what?
Komar mass.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Okay. Any questions? No? Well, then have a nice weekend.